People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon introducing you to this week's edition of People of Note, right here on Fine Music Radio. For the last 4 or 5 days, I've been immersed in the most extraordinary crime thriller called The Dark Flood, a Benny Crystal novel written by Dion Meyer, whom Wilbur Smith, the late and much lamented Wilbur Smith, calls the undisputed champion of South African crime. I hadn't read one of Dion's books before, and I'm not a fast reader, but this one had me turning pages, a page turner, and really leaving me quite traumatized and thrilled all at the same time. And now it's a great pleasure to welcome Dion Meyer himself into the People of Note studio. And Dion, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to have you here. Thanks for having me.
And as I said, it's odd to read a novel where you know you're going to introduce and interview the author, because you think, well, I must ask him this and I must ask him that. But we mustn't do any spoilers.
No, we shouldn't.
But first of all, just let me say that, tell me a little bit about Benny Crystal, a sort of ex-alcoholic, and you've used him in a few of your books, haven't you?
Yeah, I created the character 26 years ago. And he was never meant to be a protagonist. When I created him in my first translated novel called Dead Before Dying, I needed a character in a specific scene to spoil the fun of the protagonist, Mathieu Baer. And on the fly, I created a character, and I needed him to be drunk. I needed him to be a drunken cop, because he needed to be drunk for the specific scene. Usually when I create a major character, I will spend a lot of time thinking about their name and surname, because for me, that's got to feel right. But in this case, thinking that it's going to be a couple of pages that I'm going to use this character and then he's going to be gone, I did not spend a lot of time. I thought of one of my favorite teachers at school, and I thought this character sort of looks like the son of one of my favorite teachers at school. This teacher was Mr. Ben Crystal, and his son was Benny Crystal. You know, in my head, he was looking a little bit like Benny Crystal, and I called him Benny Crystal. And from the moment that Benny Crystal, the character, walked onto the page, he made things happen, and he made the process of writing easier and more exciting. And he just didn't want to go away. So by the end of the book, he had become one more than just a minor character. He had become one of the substantial characters in the book. And I liked writing about him so much that I thought, you know, I have to keep him in mind as a possible major character, in a protagonist in a future novel. And I think it took me 2 or 3 books before I found a story and I thought, this is perfect for Benny Crystal. And then I had a problem, because the whole concept of an alcoholic detective with a lot of inner demons is a bit of a cliche in the genre. There are so many of them. But I thought, I have to do something with this character. And my solution was to really start doing research about what it is to be an alcoholic. And for me, one of the beautiful parts of this story is that my translator at that time was the late, great Madeleine von Bouillon. She translated my early, I think, 3 or 4 books from Afrikaans to the English.
Because you write in Afrikaans, don't you?
I write in
Afrikaans. And then they are all translated into English.
Yeah. And Madeleine was a self-confessed and very outspoken alcoholic. So she was my first port of call. I said, Madeleine, I want to talk to you about being an alcoholic, what it's like. And she gave her signature big laugh and said, come along. And we had a lunch. And then she took me to some Alcoholics Anonymous meetings with her. I was the guest at some of these meetings. And she really made a big difference in how I approached the character and his battle with the bottle. And he's been battling to stay on the wagon all through the series. I think this is the 6th Benny Crystal and Vaughn Cupido novel. And that's how he became a... You know, and the interesting thing is, I never wanted to write a series, because I always felt that that would somehow inhibit my creativity. I wanted to tell stories, and I always thought that the story should be paramount. And if I found a story that I loved and felt passionate about, then I'll find the right characters. But it's crazy how, when you create a character, you write a novel, and the readers start reacting very positively, and publishers love a series, and they start telling you that this is a good way to go, then you find more stories to fit these characters.
Yeah, absolutely. Because first and foremost, you are a storyteller, aren't you? I think I read somewhere, as you've just said, you love telling a story.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I never thought of myself, I want to become an author. Authors were sort of these very smart people with big beards and smoked long pipes and thought deep thoughts. And I was never quite like that. I always thought of myself as just a storyteller. And I still think that is who I really am.
It was very interesting hearing you talk about how Benny Creasel came into existence, because he's drawn in such a sympathetic way that you do feel sympathy for him. His son Fritz, who keeps saying, "Are you sober?" And you just, it sort of hurts you. You think, shame, poor Benny. But there are other major characters in this book, for example. So one of my questions was going to be, how do you think up these? What comes first, the story or the characters?
For me, the story always comes first.
Right. And
that's one of the reasons why I was very hesitant to do a series, because I thought if I forced a story onto a character, it might not work. But as I said, you know, once you get your head around the fact that people really like the character and like the series, then it's funny how you sort of naturally migrate towards stories that will fit them. Yeah. I have written novels like Fever a couple of years ago that was totally different and not these characters at all, or like Trackers. But more and more I find myself finding stories that will fit Benny and Vaughn.
Okay, well, I want to find out more about how you find the stories, right, where they come from. But first of all, let's have our first music break. And I read some, and I see from your first choice that one of your favorite composers is Mozart.
I think he is my ultimate favorite. I'm a Mozart fanatic. And I chose the piano concerto number 22, K482, the Andante Cantabile, because that was my first real introduction to Mozart. That was the first time that I did not grow up with classical music per se, and I did not know Mozart's work. And I was in my, I think, late 20s when I heard this piece for the first time, and I just immediately fell in love and then started listening more and more to Mozart, and I adore him.
There we heard part of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 22, the slow movement, the Andante, and the performer there, Mitsuko Uchida, piano with the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Geoffrey Tait. And the first choice of my guest on People of Note this week, the author, Dion Meyer. And I've just been thrilled, traumatized, excited, drawn to the edge of my seat by his latest novel, The Dark Flood. And just before you broke for music, Dion, I said to you, I want to know where these stories come from. I mean, clearly, once you've got the story, you have a lot of research to do because of the incredible detail and accuracy you need to have. So, do you lie in bed and something comes? I know it's a naive question, but there you go. I want to see what you say.
No, I think it's a very fair question, and it's a question that's often asked. And the answer is story ideas come from everywhere. I think once you start becoming a full-time storyteller, then you are looking for story ideas wherever you go. I do a lot of reading. I read newspapers and magazines, and I read news online. I talk to people wherever I go. I love listening to people's stories, and you sort of collect all these story ideas in the back of your head. I used to, when I was younger, have this little notebook in which I wrote them down, and then I realized that the really good ones sort of stick.
Yeah.
You don't forget them.
Yes.
But it is often the case that you might have one idea that you think, wow, there's a lot of potential in this, but you can't quite figure out what the story is. And then a second idea often comes along, and when the two connect, there's a little spark, and you realize, wow, the combination of these two ideas, that's what's going to make the story work. For The Dark Flood, the obvious, when readers from South Africa read it, they will obviously know that it was definitely inspired by the Steinhoff saga, the great corporate scandal that happened
in Stellenbosch.
And we were living in Stellenbosch, my wife and I, Marianne and I. We moved to Stellenbosch about 11 years ago. And we very much saw the impact of the Steinhoff saga on the town. And to me, that was very interesting. But we also, just before the Steinhoff saga broke, we started looking for a house in Stellenbosch, which was not easy because we have six children between us. We both work at home. So we needed a very big house.
Yeah,
and we couldn't afford to pay some of the prices that were asked in Stellenbosch. So it took us a long time. It took us about 2 years to find the right house. And in these 2 years, we spent a lot of time with Stellenbosch estate agents. And it's an interesting job. And spending time with them, I started asking them questions about their work, their challenges, their frustrations, the interesting things that happened to them. And that was where the idea for the character Sandra Steenberg came from.
Yes.
And I didn't quite know what to make of it. I knew I wanted to have an estate agent who has some sort of a problem. And then the Steinhoff saga happened, and then you start asking questions and playing. I think the thing that I do most often in terms of story development is I play what-if games. So, you know, when you see something like Steinhoff, then you start asking yourself, what if a character that is inspired by one of these executives, what if he wants to sell his very expensive wine farm?
I see.
But he doesn't want to do it to attract attention. So that's, you add that little bit to the story. And then the other part of the story comes from a dinner that Marianne and I had with General Jeremy Vieri and his wife.
Oh, yes.
In a small Karoo town some years ago. And Jeremy was telling me the story, and I have to be very careful for no spoilers now, but he told me about a case that they had just dealt with, a case that they had wrapped up. And that was the other element that came in that created the spark, and I thought, if I can put these two things together, then we've got a story.
But it's interesting. I think we're not going to do a spoiler if we say it was about a student who went missing from Stellenbosch, a rather strange student.
No, absolutely, but that is made up. That was not part of the story that Jeremy told
me.
That was the way that I... Again, you know, these real events can only inspire. You can't copy them. For instance, this book is not about something like the Steinhoff scandal.
Yeah, no, definitely.
And one of the major reasons for that is that the Steinhoff scandal was just such an intricate and involved and convoluted bunch of transactions that you can never make crime fiction of that. You will take 100 pages just to explain the crime. But it did inspire me to start thinking about what would happen about people that were in situations like that.
Right, right.
So, and again, with the story that Jeremy told me, I started playing the game of what if.
Oh, yes.
And
yes,
this
yes.
is where this missing student, early in the novel, Benny Grissel and his colleague, Vaughn Cupido, they have to go look for a student that went missing over the weekend. They think he just had a booze up, and they are very frustrated because they are former Hawks detectives who have now
They've been demoted
and, to the low level of finding drunk students.
Yes.
But then it turns out to be a bit more than that.
Absolutely, gosh. And your device, for want of a better word, of running the two stories together, do you do that in a lot of your books? So, for example, within a chapter, there are about three or four sections where you switch between the two stories. So the reader is sort of thinking, how can these two possibly connect? And we won't say in this book if they do connect. And maybe they do, but in an unexpected sort of way. So that device, do you enjoy that sort of
Yes, I do. Device? I don't always do it. Sometimes the story is a bit more linear and singular. Mm-hmm. It depends on, you know, what you want to do with the story.
Yeah.
But I do enjoy it when it does that, because it does allow you, when the one storyline where you have to do more exposition, you can keep the suspense in the other storyline going and
right.
keep the attention. So right. it does offer you the opportunity to keep the suspense levels up.
Yeah, as it does with some degree of success in this book. What's your next choice, Dion?
My next choice is Verdi's Rigoletto, Bella Figlia dell'Amore, but specifically the recording with Joan Sutherland and Luciana Pavarotti and Richard Boninge as the conductor with the London Symphony Orchestra.
Is there a reason for this?
Well, yeah. I mean, I read Joan Sutherland's biography many years ago, and there's the beautiful story of how they picked Pavarotti to be her singing partner. And I just think that, as a matter of fact, there's a recording of a live performance of this opera on YouTube, a video.
Mm-hmm.
And the applause is longer than the aria itself, because I think it is the most exquisite way to portray both Joan Sutherland and Pavarotti's voices with two other incredible singers. It is just absolute perfection.
Piangere un po'. Truly great moments in opera, the quartet from Rigoletto, that famous recording there with Joan Sutherland and Pavarotti, the choice of my guest, the author Dion Meyer, who's on People of Note with me this week. I've just read his latest novel, The Dark Flood. I absolutely recommend you read it, but make sure you have time because it's going to become a page-turner. The other thing, Dion, that strikes me with novels, whether you're reading Frederick Forsyth or Stephen Leather or you, is the amount of research you must do. For example, in this book, all the things you talk about the police force and the various forms and the processes, is that very time-consuming?
Yes, it is. But the great thing about research is that it multiplies your creative choices. When you do no research, you have a singular story that you're going to tell, and you won't see other avenues in which the story can develop or directions that it can move in. So what research does, first and foremost, is it gives you so many more story options. Mm-hmm. When I start writing, I don't do a lot of planning in terms of what I exactly want to do with the story, because I feel that you have to sort of discover the story in the writing.
When I start, as you go along, sort of thing.
Yeah,
it's,
you know,
sort of, it's generic. It can't, not generic. What's the word? It grows.
Yeah, but it's very hard to explain, because when I start, I have an ending in mind. I can't start unless I have an ending that I think, yes, that would work and that would work well. But I hate holding on too tightly to that ending, because as I say, the moment you start doing research, and also in the development of the story, you write and then things happen on the page, or you discover something new in the research that you think, oh, this would be a much better ending, and then you start writing in that direction. And then sometimes, I mean, I've written books where I used the ending that I started with, and I've used books in which the ending changed 3 or 4 or 5 times until you, every time there's something better that you come up with it. So, but that's the thing about research, is mm-hmm. it? Well, first of all, my favorite English word is verisimilitude.
Oh, very good. And no one uses that.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, that's what especially crime fiction needs, verisimilitude. Mm. It needs that texture of the truth. It's got to feel real. So if I'm going to write about the police, I would love a police detective or a police woman or man to read the book and say, yes, he did his homework, he got it right, so I can trust him to treat the police fairly and to write a book that is believable. But I also think for the reader, it's interesting to know, for instance, when a person goes missing in South Africa, how does the police handle this when a case like that comes in? What are the procedures? I used to love that. I was hugely influenced by Ed McBain, the American crime author, who did that sort of thing wonderfully. And to me, it added a layer of reality to the story that I loved, and I eventually, I think all authors write for themselves, for the reader within. So I write the kind of stories that I would have liked to read with that sort of texture of the real world thrown in. Mm-hmm. I had the great privilege of working with the Stellenbosch detectives for a couple of days in Stellenbosch.
Actually, in Stellenbosch.
Yeah, they allowed me into this inner sanctum. I attended a morning parade meeting with them just to see how they operate and to really get to understand how they spend their time, what do they do during the day, the challenges that they have, what sort of shifts they work, who allocates the case to them, who drives them, that sort of thing. So, and again, that gives, when you write suspense fiction or crime fiction, then conflict is your major tool, because conflict is the mother of suspense. And the more you can find these little elements of conflict within their daily lives, I think the more it enhances the
more human level. They seem as yeah. well, apart from anything else. And Dion, how long did it take you to write The Dark Flood?
The problem is that, you know, with book tours and I've been involved in making television series and movies as well. It often takes me 2 years now to finish a novel. The actual writing time is perhaps 7-8 months, but from start to finish, it's often 24 months now.
Because now we're just going to move away from, otherwise it seems as if this is the only book you've ever written. It's just that it's the first one I've read of yours,
right.
And I'm so terribly impressed. And it has quite an ending, which we won't tell anybody
right.
about. But this film thing you mentioned earlier about the singer who's just died, you made. But to film script writing is also quite a big thing for you.
Yeah, you know, again, being a storyteller, there are different media to tell stories in, novels, short stories, and then movies and TV series. And sometimes you find a story idea that, you know, this is not a novel, this should be a movie. The late Tien Chiu Dan, who passed away yesterday, was a great friend of mine, and I'm still incredibly sad about his passing. I loved the man and I loved his music. My very first movie that I wrote with him in mind. I attended a concert in Bloemfontein at what was then the Volksblad Fierce, in which Tien Chiu Dan and David Kramer did a concert together. And it was the most incredibly dynamic, wonderful concert. That their energy and their the way that they gelled was just beautiful. And as we drove back to Cape Town after that concert the next day, I was just thinking, there's got to be a movie that'll can bring these two people into a story and take take this magic and share it with other people. And I wrote a script called Jakal's Dance, and I went to see Tien. So I've never met him, but I managed to make contact with him, and he loved the story, and we made a movie together. That was the start of making movies for me, and I've been involved and loving it ever since.
My goodness. It's a very different thing, as you said, from a novel, but don't you think something like, just let me once again talk about The Dark Flood, don't you think that would make an incredible film?
It's always tricky to make a film from a novel, because the adaptation, you have to throw away so much, and we've done that. I've done that. I've actually just gone through a process now where I had to adapt one of my books into a movie script. And we hope to make an exciting announcement about that in the next coming month or two. One of the challenges, for instance, was that this novel that I just adapted was published, I think, 15 years ago. And in 15 years, so much has changed in South Africa. So much has changed in terms of technology. When I wrote the book, cell phones were hardly around. And suddenly now you live in a world. So we had to do a lot of adaptation. And then the thing is, budget, of course. Making a movie costs money. Writing a novel, you can create as big a scene as you want, and it doesn't cost you 1 cent. So
yes.
There are different challenges. I love adapting novels as TV series, because then you have a lot more space to stay faithful to the book and all the characters in it. But even then, you have to make changes and adapt.
I think we need another break, another music break. Dion, and sure. What have you got for us this time?
Beethoven's Violent Concerto in D Major, Opus 61, The Rondo, by Nigel Kennedy. It's my absolutely favorite recording of Beethoven's Violent Concerto, and especially because Kennedy improvises. He He takes Beethoven's, and because Beethoven was so famous for improvisation, he and Mozart. In that spirit, Kennedy just does something beautiful with it.
Part of Beethoven's magnificent violin concerto, that famous recording with Nigel Kennedy there as the violin soloist, and it was a choice of my guests, the author, Dion Meyer, who's in the studio with me today. And Dion, you know what? You've had what seems to me to be a very interesting background. I just want to find a little bit more about your background, because you started really writing copy and stuff like that, didn't you? But you always wanted to write. Writing was always in you.
Yeah, I mean, when I was at school, I used to love writing essays. But, you know, I grew up in Klerksdorp in the Northwest Province, which is not a place known for its culture.
It's literally seen.
Yeah. So, I mean, I never entertained the hope or the idea of being a writer one day. It just never occurred to me. My father was a blue-collar worker. I grew up in a blue-collar, lower-middle-class neighborhood where your only hope was to get some sort of a degree one day and maybe become a teacher or a lawyer. I was never smart enough to become a doctor. So, you know, I hoped to be a teacher one day, and I went to Potchefstroom University and I did a BA with English and History, and hoping to get my teacher's certificate, a diploma after that. But in the process, in my third year at university, I got involved with a student organization that was helping, and this was the height of apartheid. This was 1979.
Very bad time.
Yeah, we got smuggled into the township of Potchefstroom to help black kids pass matric by giving them extra classes and teaching classes to them. And I realized after doing this for several months that for me to spend the rest of my life giving the same lesson every year, year after year, was probably not the best idea. And it so happened that my roommate at university's brother-in-law was the news editor of Die Volksblad, the newspaper in Bloemfontein. And I knew his brother-in-law, and his brother-in-law said, but why don't you come work at Die Volksblad? And that was the first time that I thought, oh, well, that sounds much more exciting than being a teacher. So on the spur of the moment, I applied for the position and was lucky enough to get it, and then sort of really rediscovered my love for writing. It was a tough learning curve. I mean, it was a harsh school to learn to write under the pressure of a daily newspaper and being a cub reporter on this. But it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah.
Because you write under pressure, you have all these very seasoned sub-editors and news editors subbing your work. I remember my very first story that I handed in had Jan Scholz, my news editor, just drew all these green pen lines through it. And that's the way that you learn to work with words. The interesting thing for me was also that I always, when I was at school and even at university, I wrote for pleasure mainly in English. I wrote little bits of fiction in English and very bad poetry in English. And that was my first real discovery of writing in Afrikaans as a writing language. So that made a big difference. And then finally I ended up becoming an advertising copywriter in Cape Town. And that was a different way of writing, but again, a rigorous training.
Very strict.
Where
every word
is weighed.
Yes.
And I loved it. I learned so much from so many people. So that by the time that I started writing fiction, short stories in my 30s, I had had very good training for 15, 20 years.
Gosh. And then I read somewhere, as one does, on Google, whoever it was, that you like riding motorbikes. You're a motorcycle enthusiast.
Yeah, I've always been. I started riding a little 50 motorcycle when I was still at school. It wasn't my own. It was actually one of my girlfriend's brothers had gone off to the military, and he said, would you ride my bike for me while I'm not here? Absolutely fell in love with motorcycling, and I was not without a motorcycle until about 3-4 years ago, when finally my schedule just wasn't allowing me enough time to ride a motorbike anymore.
Oh, so you're not riding around the country on a motorcycle? They say that's one of your things to relax.
No, well, I used to do a lot of it, and I also consulted as a brand consultant to a very big motorcycle company in South Africa for 6 years. That was my full-time job, just to create events for motorcycle riders of this of this company. And I did probably 100,000 kilometers of motorcycle riding all over Southern Africa for 6 years.
Good.
So I've done my bit, and my wife loves being on the motorcycle with me. But a couple of years ago, we realized that we haven't had time for a whole year to enjoy the motorcycle, and we said, well, we're going to sell it until one day, if we have the time again, we'll buy another one. But between writing and book tours and the TV work, there wasn't time. I've never been the kind of motorcycle rider who could only do a quick breakfast run to Franschhoek on a Sunday morning. For me, motorcycling, I did mostly off-road or adventure motorcycling, where you go into the Bundu for 5, 6, 7 days. That was the kind of riding that I loved.
Right. Clear your mind.
Yeah.
Now we've got a Rossini string sonata coming up as your next choice of music.
Yeah, it was my very first money that I made from one of my book translations. I was in London, and I used the money to buy a very good little portable CD player. And I was in London at one of the big music stores, and this was the very first CD that I bought for this little music player. And I remember listening to the CD over and over on this whole book tour in the UK, and I think I went over to America as well, and just absolutely loved it. So I have very fond memories of the specific.
You know that Rossini was 12 when he wrote it.
That's right.
Yeah, he was very young.
Yeah. Okay. And it's one of his most beautiful works. Yeah.
Thank you. the music of a very young Rossini there, one of his string sonatas, and another choice of my guest on People of Note this week, Dion Meyer. And Dion, you were talking just now about translation, and you said you write your novels in Afrikaans, they then translated. Would you not consider writing something like The Dark Flood in English? And when it is translated, do they manage to keep the nuances? It certainly seems as though they do.
Well, for me, writing is hard enough in Afrikaans, which is my mother tongue. You know, I would be able to write something like that in English. It's just going to take much longer and might be much harder. Because when you write, I think words have a certain energy and a feeling and a texture, and you've got to find the right word for whatever you're trying to say. And finding the right word in English is always just takes me frustratingly much longer. So, and you know, as I said, it's my mother tongue. It's the language that I'm in most comfortable in. And it's something that I can do for a language that, like a lot of smaller languages in the world, is a little bit under threat. So
absolutely. Yeah. And so now it's been enriched by these novels of yours. And I wish I could find, right, there's a scene in which Sandra is in the house, the garage. I have to be careful not to do any spoilers. And it's raining. And you used a lovely phrase of the rain on the roof. And I'm not going to remember it now. And if I try and look for it, can you remember?
I can't remember. Okay, no.
We'll remember after the interview.
Yeah, you know, the translation, I often get asked what gets lost in translation, and I don't think anything gets lost in translation because, I mean, in the Afrikaans version, Vaughan Cupido speaks Cape Flats Afrikaans, mm-hmm. which is a dialect of Afrikaans that I absolutely adore. I think it is the most musical and beautiful version of Afrikaans, but there's no way that you can translate that. But then again, if you're an English reader in the UK who've never heard Cape Flats Afrikaans, you're not going to appreciate it. So what you need to do is to translate Vaughan's dialogue into something that works for him as a character and makes the story go forward. My argument has always been that story is an international language. Character humanity is an international language. And if you can get the humanity of the characters right and you get the story right, readers will never lose anything in the translation. But having said that, my translator, Laura Siegers, she's incredibly good, and we work together very closely. You know, every 10 chapters that she's translated, she'll send me. I'll go through there, and I'll make sure that every word in there is true to what I meant as the author. So I'm very happy that once the English translation is done, that it is as good as the Afrikaans in every single way.
But I see in this book, I don't know if you do it in all your books, but you put a lot of what Cupido says in italics.
Yeah.
And at the back, you've got a glossary of all these Afrikaans and terms that are used on the Cape Flats.
Yeah.
That even maybe some white people in Cape Town would not understand.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that keeps the sort of texture, doesn't it, of that character?
No, I think so. I mean, we also do that in the UK edition. This is very much the South African edition that is, I think, 3 or 4 months before the UK edition and the American edition, and we do the glossary specifically for those overseas markets as well.
Okay. So you sell very well internationally, don't you, if I've read my books well? 11 novels, short stories, you sell internationally well.
I'm very blessed with that.
You're very blessed. And Dion, as we reach the end of our interview, is it silly of me to say, is there another book? Is there another story in your mind?
There is. I have started on a new novel. We're just finishing some television work at the moment. And then I hope in December to get really stuck in. And it should be out in Afrikaans next year.
Are you a disciplined writer? Do you write at a certain time of day?
Yeah, I am. I think that's the only way that you can get a book done. I get up quite early in the morning. I hope to start at around about 6 o'clock every morning. And then usually I write until lunchtime, unless I am almost done with the book. The last quarter of a book, I will often write 14, 16 hours a day because you feel you have to finish it.
Mm-hmm. And do you have, what sort of writing space do you have?
It's got to be quiet, so I don't listen to music while I write, and it's got to be dark because the more distractions there are, the easier it is not to concentrate. Mm. So I have a room, a sort of a study, in which I sit. All the blinds are closed.
Oh, really?
I sit with my back to the window, and
That's not what I expected you to say. I thought you were going to say you sat looking at the beautiful mountains.
No, because looking at the mountains is not going to get the book done, you know. So I really try to minimize the distractions as much as I can. Mm-hmm. You know, every morning when you sit down, it takes you a half an hour to get your head into this world again.
Well, of course.
And the moment that you are distracted, it takes you another half an hour to get in there. So I try to focus. And
I wonder how you stop. You think, right, I'm stopping there for today. That's it. I need a break.
Yeah, you know, I will often write a chapter and then finish and then walk away, go have tea with my wife, thinking about the next chapter and how I want to start it, and then I'll come back. So I won't write for hours on end. Usually it's about 60 to 90 minutes of writing and then taking a quick break, just gathering my thoughts, sometimes rewriting. That's my
And how you don't ride your motorbike about anymore, so how do you relax? Do you go for walks? Do you climb mountains?
We do mountain biking.
You do
Marianne
mountain
biking? Yeah. Okay. It's a lot of the same technical challenges of riding a motorcycle off-road, but you can do that in an hour every day. We sort of ride 5 days a week. We do an hour or 2 hours of riding in the beautiful Stellenbosch Mountains.
Right.
We do a bit of walking. We love traveling. Reading movies.
How about a book one day that involves classical music? Maybe a musician whose violin is stolen.
I've considered that. You know, I mean,
with your love of Mozart.
Yeah, Beethoven. Yeah. I have a character in one of my previous books called Lemmer, who was a very big Mozart fan. Yeah.
Ah, okay. Dion, we're going to have to stop now, as much as I'm enjoying this. But what I've particularly enjoyed about our conversation is hearing you speak about the nuts and bolts of writing a book and of these characters that you create. So thank you for sharing that with us. And what's your last piece of music?
Well, Roddy, thank you very much for having me. My last bit of music is I became a grandfather this year.
Oh, congratulations.
And it's for my grandson, and it's Elizabeth Mitchell's You Are My Sunshine.
That's a lovely way to end. Dion Meyer, thank you very much. And don't forget to look at Dion's latest book, The Dark Flood, and you'll see what I mean when you get into that. Thanks, Dion.
Thank you, Rodney.
Sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away. The other night, dear, when I lay sleeping, I dreamt I held you. Mistaken, so I hung my head and cried. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away. Skies are gray. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away. Please don't take my sunshine away. Please don't take my sunshine away. Thank you.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions. FMR.